The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
A few weeks, I've been talking about aspects of the Noble Eightfold Path, and tonight I'd like to start talking about the section of the path that relates to our conduct in the world. So one way that the Eightfold Path can be viewed is through a gradual training where we begin with our relationships in the world, looking at creating harmony and kindness, interacting in a way of non-harming. And that's the aspect of sila, or ethics, the ethical training. And then we move to exploring the inner landscape a little more carefully through the exploration of samadhi, or the concentration aspect of the Eightfold Path. And those two aspects together, the ethical aspect and the meditative concentration aspect, lead towards the wisdom aspect of the path. So the Eightfold Path is usually described as, the eight factors are usually described as beginning with right understanding and right thought, which I talked about for the last 2 weeks, and then moving to right speech, right action, right livelihood, which are this component of the ethical aspect of the path. And then the last three aspects of the Eightfold Path are wise effort, wise mindfulness, and wise concentration, which is the samadhi aspect, the meditative aspect. And so the kind of an interesting balance here, as I mentioned the first night that I talked about the Eightfold Path, that in the traditional way that the Eightfold Path is described, the path begins with right understanding and right thought, this understanding of a little bit about what's skillful and unskillful in terms of leading us towards happiness and out of suffering. And what are the intentions that support that? So to some extent, the practice can be looked at as starting with those qualities. And it also ends with those qualities, because those two aspects of right, wise understanding, wise thought, are the wisdom aspect of the Eightfold Path. And so the path can sort of be said to kind of come into a circle, where we need a little bit of wisdom to begin on the path, and the culmination of the path is the full fruition, the full development of that wisdom. And so in terms of entering into the path of spiritual practice, of meditative practice, but one place to look at entering into this path is through this area of ethical conduct. Because there's also this gradual training where it begins with this ethical component. So one place to begin our path of practice is in looking at our relationship to the world, how we get along with other people. It's often these three aspects of the Eightfold Path, or three factors of the Eightfold Path, that come under this aspect of ethics, or sila is the Pali term, sila, are right speech, right action, and right livelihood. Tonight I'm going to just talk a little bit about the ethical aspect in general, and then talk about right speech. So in our spiritual journey, it's helpful to have a skillful, kind relationship with the world, towards others. That that our actions are motivated out of kindness and compassion. And this, the understanding about this with respect to the Noble Eightfold Path is that this isn't so much because it's right, although the typical translation of the Eightfold Path lends us to think of it that way, right speech, right action, right livelihood. But the rightness about it is more along the lines of wise. What's helpful for us in terms of moving towards happiness and away from suffering? So it's really pragmatic here. It's not so much about what is seen as right and wrong from some judging on from above. It is really practical about looking at what actions, when we engage in them, lead us towards suffering, cause harm to self and others, and what actions lead us more towards connection, towards harmony. In fact, the term for ethics, the term, the Pali term sila, is said to be explained in terms of another word, samadana, which is the term for harmony. And so this exploration of ethics or sila is about looking at harmonizing with the world. We can look at it in terms of social harmony, how our relationships function, the outward, essentially the outward impact of our behavior. We can look at it in terms of personal harmony, internal harmony, that when we behave in a way that doesn't cause harm towards self or others, then we end up feeling a kind of relaxation, a freedom from remorse, what's often called the bliss of blamelessness. So this brings in a harmony in the mind, the engaging in ethical conduct, the outward manifestation towards others, results in some harmony in the mind as well. And then it also supports what we could call a contemplative harmony, that this harmony of ethical conduct in the world supporting the mind relaxing supports the container for settling into meditation, settling and stabilizing the mind even more deeply. So it's supportive conditions to allow the practice of a deeper kind of purification, a deeper kind of letting go, to take place in our contemplation, in our meditative practice. So the factors of ethics, of wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood, are mostly worded in the negative as actions that we should avoid. And this too, I think, we connect with the kind of Ten Commandments notion of morality, thou shalt not, being something that we have to do as opposed to something to explore and to learn from. So they are worded in the negative. Yet in that abstinence, in abstaining from certain actions, the primary thing isn't the abstaining itself, but it is the purification of mind that results, the intention in that abstinence from certain actions there is or can be an intention to cultivate some beautiful qualities of mind as well. So, for example, if you refrain from lying, you're cultivating the inner quality of truthfulness. So it's really exploring this intentionality of our actions. The refraining from certain actions has a rebound effect on the mind. We often think about or know, we understand that when certain mind states come up, certain attitudes of mind, that can come out in our behavior. So we're very familiar with that direction of an interconnection between mind and body. But if we're angry, we tend to act in an angry fashion. So that direction of the connection between mind and body is familiar to us. And it is also a connection. There's also a connection going the other way. If we behave in ways that are peaceful, harmonious, the underlying intention that is at the root of that behavior has a rebound effect on the mind and begins to settle the mind towards more peacefulness, towards more calm, more harmony. So this is part of how these ethical qualities work. Through the abstaining of certain actions, we cultivate beautiful, wholesome qualities internally. So the basis of ethics in the Buddhist teachings primarily had to do with cultivating a clarity of mind and a clarity of intention. And we start to see, as we cultivate that clarity of mind and clarity of intention and engage in these actions, that there's not so much of a distinction in what is good for ourselves and what is good for others. That when we behave ethically, it supports this harmony outwardly and it supports this inward harmony. So we benefit internally from this kind of action. So we start to think more in terms of what's skillful, what's helpful in terms of happiness, and what isn't so helpful, what's unskillful, rather than in terms of this notion of right and wrong. So the first of these three aspects of this of sila, right speech, right action, right livelihood, is right speech. And so I'll talk about this aspect of wise speech. So being one of the main ways we interact with the world, speech is a huge area for us to work with bringing our awareness to. And I know everybody here has their own story around a time when they weren't aware when they said something and the impact that that had. A slip of thoughtlessness and immediately wishing that we could take back what we'd said. So the engagement in wise speech supports this movement to take care with how we engage through language. And as I talk about wise speech, also think about how you engage in email as well. Email is a very active source of communication these days. In some ways we do more emailing than talking. At least I know in the work situation I was in, I did way more emailing than speaking. So including that in this exploration of wise speech. It's really about wise communication. Wise communication. With respect to the speech aspect of it, Gill and Tanjeff have some interesting ways of looking at it. Gill likes to, or has in several times in the past, referred to this wise speech as mindfulness out loud. That we need to bring our mindful attention to our speech. And Thanissaro Bhikkhu, Tanjeff, says that his teacher liked to say, if you can't control your mouth, there's no way that you'll be able to control your mind. Because the mind moves way more quickly than speech. So we can look at it as an exploration of how to begin to tap into the quickness of the reactivity in our minds. There's a little bit of a lag before we say something. I mean, the mind has already moved into reaction, but there's just a split second before we say something. So there's a little bit more chance to catch the reactivity before it gets expressed in verbal behavior. So this area of wise speech, mindful speech, being a kind of a broad look at wise speech. It's a very challenging practice. Much of the time when we speak, we really speak without even being aware that we're going to speak before we speak. And we rarely have a clear sense of what we're going to say before we say it. And even much less of an understanding of what the impact might be on the person we're speaking to. So exploring wise speech can help in these areas. And I'll talk a little more detail later on about some specific ways to play with this. So the Buddha provided some specific guidelines about wise speech, some specific types of speech to avoid. So this is a little more narrow than mindful speech. This is pointing us to specific ways of speaking that tend to be harmful, that tend to cause pain and suffering, not only for others but for ourselves. And these four kinds of speech are false speech, divisive speech, harsh speech, and idle chatter. So I'm going to talk about each of these. I mean, just the list sounds daunting, doesn't it? So false speech. For each of these, I'm going to read you what the definition is from the texts. So this is abstaining from false speech. Herein, someone avoids false speech and abstains from it. He speaks the truth, is devoted to truth, reliable, worthy of confidence, not a deceiver of people. Being at a meeting or amongst people or in the midst of his relatives or in a society or in the king's court, and called upon and asked as a witness to tell what he knows, he answers, if he knows nothing, I know nothing. And if he knows, he answers, I know. If he has seen nothing, he answers, I have seen nothing. And if he has seen, he answers, I have seen. Thus, he never knowingly speaks a lie, either for the sake of his own advantage or for the sake of another person's advantage, or for the sake of any advantage whatsoever. So the notion of false speech is really around the intention to deceive. That's really what almost defines the false speech. So if, for example, you say something having heard information from somewhere, who somebody's told you, oh, this is such and such happened, and then you tell somebody else such and such happened, and then you later find out it didn't. It wasn't your intention to deceive in that speech. So that's not what we're talking about by false speech. We're talking about speech that's actively engaged with the intention to deceive. So lying can be motivated out of either greed, aversion, or delusion. The greedy side of it is aimed at some personal advantage, or perhaps some advantage for someone else. Just at wanting something, whether it's wealth or status or some kind of respect or admiration. Just that engagement in deceit in order to gain some personal advantage. That's motivated out of that movement of greed in the mind. It can be motivated out of aversion, hatred, where the lie is actually intending to hurt someone. But that's the motivation behind it, to cause someone pain. And it can be motivated out of delusion. Things like exaggeration, white lies, or humor, even. Or to make a story more interesting. I found myself in this situation when I was in the Peace Corps. Some of my friends had very interesting stories, and I had my own interesting stories, but occasionally in my letters home, I would write the stories of my friends in the first person. And this was before I really started the practice, and so I'd write these letters, and I'd describe this story and just tell it in the first person. One old friend of mine had at some point said, you know, stories are always more interesting and compelling if they're told in the first person. And so I adopted my friend's story. And then this letter went out to many people because it was kind of a broadcast letter. My mother went out to my mother. And my mother loved this story. And then I began the meditation practice, and I started getting really uncomfortable with this story. And my mom, you know, we'd be in a group of people, and my mom would say, oh, tell that story. And I would just be silent, you know. I just didn't go there. I just didn't feel comfortable telling the story again in the first person. It wasn't what had happened to me. But it took me a very long time before I could come clean with my mother. And there was one time, it was a gathering of friends, there were probably 10 or so people, and my mom said, oh, tell that story. And I said, Mom, it's not my story. You know, in front of this whole group of people, I said, you know, I told it in the first person because I thought it would be more interesting. And interestingly enough, she said, all those people I've lied to? And a friend of mine said, you didn't lie. So now that's the definition. Remember, it's the intention to deceive. So, you know, that. But for me, the intention of the adopting it as my story, you know, as I think back on it, this is really motivated out of delusion. This is wanting to make a story more interesting so that people will think I'm an interesting person. So this is delusion. And this kind of motivation for lying can be really subtle, really subtle. To his own son, the Buddha said, when one is not ashamed to tell a deliberate lie, there's no evil that one would not do. Therefore, Rahula, you should train thus. I will not utter a falsehood even as a joke. So this can be challenging for us, particularly around this area of delusion, the white lies, the subtle exaggerations or not so subtle exaggerations, the making a story more interesting. the humor. But looking at what it is underneath, that's really the point here. What's the motivation? Look at the motivation. And, you know, the motivation being humor, there's many truthful things that are extremely humorous. Just look at our own minds. Speaking truthfully can actually be one of the greatest sources of humor. White lies are also another area where we have difficulty. You know, somebody invites you over to dinner and asks you, oh, how did you like the meal? And you didn't particularly like it. So what do you say? I mean, the easiest thing to do is to just say, oh, it was lovely, right? And that's a white lie. I mean, it's maybe not even a white lie. It's a lie designed to not cause harm in a way. I mean, that's where we really struggle with this, because we feel like if we tell them the truth, that will hurt them. So that's a skillful motivation, to not want to hurt our friend. But is there another way to express that caring intention? Or a truthful thing that could be said about the evening? I'm having a lovely evening. Rather than directly answering the question, how did you like the meal? I'm having a lovely evening. Speaking truthfully in a way that creates harmony. So the action or the abstinence from this false speech supports the cultivation of truthfulness. As it says here in the text, he speaks the truth, is devoted to the truth, reliable, worthy of confidence, not a deceiver of people. Those are beautiful qualities. The second kind of speech is divisive speech, sometimes called slanderous speech or tale-bearing. Here's the section from that. She avoids slanderous speech and abstains from it. What she has heard here, she does not repeat there, so as to cause dissension there. And what she has heard there, she does not repeat here, so as to cause dissension here. Thus she unites those that are divided, and those are united she encourages. Concord gladdens her, she delights and rejoices in concord, and it is concord that she spreads by her words. So again, you can kind of see the pairing of the avoiding divisive speech, creating the wholesome, beautiful qualities of unity and harmony. So this divisive speech is this speech intended to divide, to create division, to create ill will. Sometimes people talk about this as gossip, you know, talking about people behind their backs or talking about a third person who's not here. And sometimes people say the Buddha said not to gossip. The Buddha said not to cause division. So it is fine to speak about someone who's not present as long as the purpose is not to divide them there from these people here. So it's the divisiveness that's the issue. It's fine to talk about a dear friend with care and concern in your heart. So this divisive speech is usually motivated out of aversion and hatred, and it is designed essentially to tear others down. The third kind is harsh speech. He avoids harsh language and abstains from it. He speaks such words as are gentle, soothing to the ear, loving, such words as go to the heart, that are courteous, friendly, and agreeable to many. So harsh speech is speech that we utter in anger, that we talk, our words are intended to cause the hearer pain. Again, this is also usually motivated out of anger, some kind of aversion or ill will. And we can think about this in different ways. There's different ways that this harsh speech can manifest. It might simply manifest as language that is harsh. Just using obscenities, things like that. Then there's what we might call abusive speech, where we're speaking with bitter words. You know, that when you're angry with somebody and speaking with words designed to hurt, that bitter quality to them. That's abusive speech. Then there's insult, you know, rude speech that may not particularly have harsh words, but designed to offend. And then there's sarcasm, which perhaps on the surface of it sounds fine, but the underlying intent and the meaning conveyed through body language or through tone of voice, the hearer knows that irony is intended and that you're not saying what you mean. In fact, you're saying the opposite. So the cultivation of refraining from this kind of harsh speech has the rebound effect of cultivating courtesy, friendliness. What else does it say? Gentleness, soothing, loving, courteous, friendly, agreeable. Creating harmony, again. Both sides, looking at refraining from one, supports the cultivation of the other. The third, idle chatter, the one I think we have the most difficulty with in terms of understanding why we would need to avoid this. Here's the, and I like the Pali for idle chatter. Sampapalapa. It kind of sounds like what it is. Sampapalapa. So here's the section. She avoids idle chatter and abstains from it. She speaks at the right time and in accordance with facts, speaks what is useful, speaks of the Dharma and the discipline. Her speech is like a treasure uttered at the right moment, accompanied by reason, moderate and full of sense. So idle chatter is really what one person says pointless talk that communicates nothing of value. So that's what idle chatter is about. And the intention around idle chatter, I think, probably usually often comes out of delusion. I could see it might also come out of anxiety. You know, you might have a feeling of anxiety and just like be babbling away to fill space if you're uncomfortable with silence. It can also come out of just the sense of some kind of delusion, a sense of not really being clear about what might be a thing of value to say. So monastics are encouraged and enjoined to speak about the Dharma, to keep conversation to the topics of Dharma. Lay people, it's understood that lay people have a reason to engage in small talk with family and friends. That's part of the connection creating with lay people. It creates a cohesion, a sense of connection at times. But care should be taken in that kind of small talk to notice when it moves beyond that sense of connecting to just kind of pointless chatter. In that kind of pointless chatter, you'll start to see, if you observe your mind, you'll start to see that the mind gets kind of restless in that space of idle chatter. You know, it's not conducive to settling and quieting the mind, to just have this babbling conversation go on. Bhikkhu Bodhi points out that this kind of wise speech, abstaining from idle chatter, in terms of the actual definition from the texts, mostly refers to one's own engagement with idle chatter, and not necessarily that one needs to remove oneself when other people are speaking with idleness, in that kind of idle, pointless way. But he points out that in our culture now, with so much stimulus coming in from television, from radio, from the internet, that we may want to look at how much idleness we're introducing to our minds through that medium and consider what we want to allow in. Do we really want to take ourselves into the space of that restless, pointless communication, lot of it? There's definitely stuff on television, on radio, that is not pointless. I mean, that is not pointless, that has a point. But a lot of it is kind of got that quality of just useless chatter. So looking, using discernment in what we let in to our minds. So in this area, what we're cultivating as we refrain from this kind of idle chatter, we're cultivating an intention towards clarity of mind, towards letting go of the restless mind, towards a settled mind. So these may sound daunting in some ways, and I, in reviewing these and in reviewing some of the texts around wise speech, actually I was mostly just kind of perusing through one of the commentarial texts one afternoon, and I came upon this list that talks about how these kinds of speech, these kinds of unwise speech, as we go through the process of waking up, when each of these kinds of speech falls away. So there's understood to be, I'll just describe a little bit about this whole process of waking up, just briefly, so you can get a sense of this. It, in the Buddhist kind of model of how we come into more and more awareness, there's said to be four different stages of waking up. And there, you know, at each stage of waking up, it's said that there's more and more things that are let go of. That at the early stages of waking up, some of the more obvious things are let go of. And then at the later stages, more and more difficult things to let go of start to be let go. And then at the last stage of awakening, all forms of clinging are released. So it's essentially looking at these four stages as being, what kinds of clinging do we let go of first, and then what takes a little bit longer? And these stages, you know, the first stage is said to be not terribly difficult to reach, although not that many people worldwide seem to reach it. The other three are much more challenging. And so in this model of these four stages of awakening, I was quite surprised to find that these four kinds of speech, I thought that, you know, it's like this is in the ethical component of the Eightfold Path. I kind of figured they would all fall away early. Well, it said that the false speech falls away really early. So at the first stage of waking up, false speech falls away. So that notion of that just out and out telling a lie, that falls away. But it's not until the third stage that harsh speech and divisive speech fall away. It's not until the third stage. It's not until full letting go of all forms of clinging that idle chatter falls away. So, give yourself a break. This is a process of exploring these forms of speech. Our task is not so much to try to blindly follow these, to shoehorn ourselves into being perfect around these forms of speech. Because it's not going to happen until we're really, really fully liberated, that they all go away, until all clinging is released. At least according to this map that I read about in one of the main commentaries. So the practice is about looking at it. Look at when we engage in this kind of speech. Look at when we have the intention to engage in this kind of speech. Look back at our intention. Can we clarify our intention and bring to the fore this movement towards harmony as much as we can, and be compassionate when we make mistakes? Now, saying that being compassionate doesn't mean go engage in these kinds of speech. That's not what I'm saying. You know, I'm not saying just go out and do these things, but really use it as an exploration and know that it is a process. It's not going to happen like that. It's a real path of practice. I mean, looking at this or thinking about this, we could look at the exploration around speech as being a key way that we move towards letting go of all forms of clinging. I also think this points to the fact that these four kinds of speech are let go of over the whole course of the process of awakening, points to the folded nature of the Eightfold Path. That we don't get all the way through cultivating ethics before we move on to cultivating the aspects of meditation. That they work together. That we work on the ethical component, we work on the we engage in practices to support the meditative components. And they all support each other. So working with wise speech, it's not so much to follow them as hard and fast rules. If we're doing that, we're cultivating aversion, probably. Or greed. We may think, I'm going to be perfect at this, and that's going to be my manifestation of perfection. I'm going to do this, and that's greed. So noticing when these kinds of speech come up, looking at the intention. So practicing wise speech, practicing mindful speech too. One of the most helpful things to practice is seeing if you can pause before you speak. If you simply can put in a split second pause before you say something, that means that you have recognized that you're going to speak before you speak. If you can take a split second to just wait, You've recognized that you're going to speak before you speak. And in that split second, you have an opportunity to see what you're going to say. In that split second, you'll probably have a pretty good idea of what you're going to say. You might even be able to see why you're going to say it. You might see the motivation underneath. And you might even be able to recognize that it might have an impact on the other person. So this simple exercise of pausing can be very powerful. As we do this kind of exercise, you'll probably start to see many different kinds of motivations for speech, as I've been pointing to through this time, that these unskillful kinds of speech usually have some kind of motivation behind them. The intention to divide, the intention to puff oneself up, the intention to be seen as smart or intelligent, the intention to make somebody feel bad. There's many kinds of motivation, and can you touch into that in that moment of pausing? So sometimes there can be situations, particularly at work. I've been in situations at work where if I paused before speaking, then I would never get a word in to the conversation, because the kind of dynamic in many work environments is that, you know, practically cutting somebody off at the end of what they say and launching into the what you want to say. So there's, if you take a pause, you're probably never going to get to say what you're going to say. So one technique to help this, to insert a space, essentially to insert a space in a conversation, and this comes from from the practice of nonviolent communication. There's a whole training in learning how to speak with a nonviolent intention in one's heart. And the suggestion is to rephrase what was just said as a way to insert a little bit of a pause, so that you might say, as I understand what you just said, and then rephrase it, which gives a little bit of a space. And it does have the impact of letting the person who was speaking know that they were heard, and it gives you a chance to recognize what your response is and what your motivation is in terms of what you're saying. So you can use that kind of thing to help in challenging situations. Another tool that I found helpful with respect to working with speech is moving into mindful speech is challenging. And my first movement was simply just to try to recognize that I was speaking while I was speaking, just so that I would know that I was speaking while I was speaking. And that's even hard enough as it is, to just recognize that you're speaking while you're speaking. But that's a good ground to start with. Even if you can't recognize the motivation or recognize the intention to speak, if you can recognize that you're speaking while you're speaking, that's a step. Once you can do that, once you can get to that place of knowing you're speaking while you're speaking, it can often be really helpful to just check in. Is there agitation or ease in the heart while speaking? Just a very simple check-in at that gross level. Is there a sense of something feels off, or is there a sense of settled relaxation? If there's a settled relaxation, then, you know, you can probably just continue with the speaking and being aware of the speaking and tracking that kind of settledness. If that sense of agitation comes up, you might want to take a pause and check in a little bit. Well, what's my motivation? Or what's happening that kind of agitation is coming up? Another thing that I have personally found very difficult to engage in mindful speech routinely throughout my day. So it's from what I, in talking to other teachers about mindful speech, they pretty much all say it is one of the most difficult areas to bring mindfulness to. It's really, really challenging. So it helps to practice, to find a time to actually practice when the person that you're talking to knows that you're practicing. So it doesn't have to be this kind of covert thing that you're doing at work. Make a lunch date with a friend that also wants to practice this and practice it together. Encourage each other with it. In my own experience, the easiest thing, the easiest topic to talk about when you're trying to be mindful of speaking is mindful speaking. So that's a good place to start. And I had hoped that I would have time to do an exercise with you tonight, but you can all breathe a sigh of relief. We don't have time to do the exercise. What I'd encourage you to do is find some time where you can get together with somebody and talk about what it feels like to be mindful while you're speaking. What comes up for you? It's helpful to have somebody that you know pretty well, perhaps, in this, or somebody that you feel pretty comfortable with. And just spend the first 5 minutes or so of the conversation talking about what it feels like to be mindful while you're speaking. So for me, what it feels like right now, I'll just model this for you a little bit, that right now there's just a tiny bit of tension in my body particularly. I'm noticing a little bit of tension. I feel like I'm pulling myself up. And as I notice that, the body kind of starts to relax. And as I do that, then the mind starts to relax. And I'm noticing that as the body and the mind start to relax, that the speed of my speech is slowing down. And I'm getting a little more thoughtful, a little more careful, a little more quiet, actually. There's actually less to say at this moment. So in engaging with this with a friend, one time I did this with a friend. I think the first time I did this, we got together for lunch, and I watched these ideas come up in my mind about what I wanted to say. And each time I saw something come up, it was like, well, that's just wanting to make myself look good, or that's some other skew, you know. It's like, and I sat there for a while not saying anything, and at some point I had to say, you know, I'm sitting here ruling out things to say because I see, you know, the motivation isn't so helpful. So that I could say with, you know, not feeling like it was a skewed motivation. It's like, oh, and this is what's happening right now. I'm ruling things out. Another interesting practice around mindful speech is to explore silence, particularly if you're in a larger group. Or even if you're not, I mean, even if it's just a couple of you, Gil likes to give the instruction, is what you're going to say improve on the silence? Now that can be challenging because many of us in social situations are not comfortable in silence. And so it does feel like anything is better than the silence. So just exploring that. And, you know, in a larger group setting, if there's a bunch of people, you know, you have the option to be silent and not necessarily have to speak. You can look at your kind of the movement. You could have it be a practice sometime. You know, look at the movement to jump into the conversation. And say, what's that about? What's that about? So, I always have more words to say, but I'm just going to stop and see if there's anything. We only have a few minutes, but see if there's anything that you'd like to say or to ask. Or
I find that in addition to the overt speech, the internal dialogue, I often carry on the internal imaginary conversation with somebody. And that's much harder.
Oh, yes.
It's much harder to be mindful
of. It's much harder to be mindful of that because it's happening at the speed of thought. So, you know, that's where I was saying, you know, when it's coming out into words, there's a little bit of a lag. You know, that but we do carry on these conversations in our minds.
Do you have any suggestions?
Well, you know, when you notice that you're engaged in that, so you'll at some point kind of wake up into that internal conversation. And in that waking up, really helpful to check into the kind of momentum of energy that's behind it. You know, is there a sense of, you know, sometimes when we have thoughts in our minds, it's like we're trying to convince somebody of something, or that we're arguing with them about something. So there's some like internal kind of push or motivation. So checking into that and seeing if you can just meet that experience. You know, it's kind of like if we meet the energy of that wanting or that frustration or whatever is kind of motivating that internal conversation. If we meet that energy, sometimes the conversation is a way to try to navigate that feeling, and as opposed to directly meeting it. And if we can turn and directly meet that feeling, sometimes the kind of spin into the thoughts and the conversation won't happen so quickly. So to just turn the attention to the kind of emotional energy underlying the conversation. Oh, we should stop. Oh, well, it's 9 o'clock, so you may say one thing, but to those of you who need to leave, thank you. Go ahead.
Okay,
Go ahead.
Something that I've always done and find works really well is to not ask someone for lunch, but for a hike, you know, in the woods. That's my big thing. But you can just walk and talk, and it works out really well for me. And I've done it with my children, too, even when we're having dissension, you know. Something about being out in the woods, it just, you don't talk real fast or anything, it just works out better.
Mm-hmm. And you can use the container of nature mm-hmm. to support the presence.
It really works for me.
Thank you.
So thank you all.